Get to Old Navy for Star Spangled Style. Right now, everything's on sale, up to 60% off. That's right, get everything from tees, shorts, dresses, and swim, all at 60% off. Now till July 7th at Old Navy and OldNavy.com. Valid through 7/7, select styles only.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to At The Movies with me, Umar Paganampagepagan. Renegade auteur John Carpenter injects B-movie genres, horror, sci-fi, action with the bravura, stylistic technique of classical Hollywood giants like Howard Hawks and John Ford. Often overlooked, ignored even, Carpenter has one of the most consistent and coherent bodies of work in modern cinema. He delivers thrills with his mastery of the widescreen frame, instantly recognizable synthesizer scores, and defiantly anti-establishment attitude. He is the poster child for indie filmmaking. He writes, directs, edits, produces, composes. He does not let the big Hollywood types dictate how his film should be, and he has shown that you can gain real power and influence and relevance while still staying independent. Joining me today to talk John Carpenter are fellow film nerds and filmmakers Kai Baha and Tony Pietra Arjuna. So, gentlemen, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to me about the genius of John Carpenter. We're not even pretending that it's anything else. Okay. We're just going to be three fanboys talking about John Carpenter, right?
Oh, yes.
So
it's all in the reflexes.
So I got to admit, though, like, it's a good move to have Tony here because I did not think I had watched as much John Carpenter as either of you have. And then upon realizing that I actually have, but I didn't know it was John Carpenter to begin with.
Oh, see, that's always a good thing.
Yeah.
The rediscovery of it. Tony is, of course, encyclopedic, which is why I have him here.
Well, yeah, well, as far as I know anyway.
But guys, you know, the reason why I wanted to speak to you about this was about 3 or 4 weeks ago, Guillermo del Toro went on this tweeting blitz about John Carpenter. And he was like, America, you are so stupid. Why do you not recognize this genius among you? And I was reading those tweets and then I was like, oh my God, he's absolutely right. It's been such a long time since I've revisited John Carpenter. And when I looked through his filmography, I found that he has directed so many of my favorite movies, the movies I keep watching over and over and over again.
Likewise, yeah.
So what's it been like for you guys? Why are you fans of John Carpenter?
It all started, with Escape from New York, actually. I think that was probably the first Carpenter film I ever saw, on a scroungy little VHS sometime in 1984. Yeah, that's how old I am. It was either that or Christine or Starman, but I think if I recollect correctly, it was Escape from New York. But from that point onwards, I think it was, even at that young age, I noticed, one of the things you first noticed was, every time his film came out was, John Carpenter's so-and-so.
Correct. Mm.
So that's how you identified him. And I think that's the first time I understood what directing was all about, because there was a stamp on it, somebody, always had a hand in it. And the second thing that came identifiable with him was, of course, his music. Every one of his films pretty much always starts off with that one chord minimalist bass line. And it's in dum 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 dum.
Well, for people who don't know,
John
Carpenter is the poster child for indie filmmaking,
right?
He writes, directs, produces, edits,
composes.
And composes.
Right. Yeah. And he pretty much pioneered all of that, but he was in a way he was both a product of his time and way ahead of it, because back then mainstream critics pretty much wrote him off as a B-grade filmmaker.
Before we did this, man, I was doing some research as to critical reception of some of his films.
Yep. Oh, not a lot of them have gotten good reception.
No, I swear to God, mainstream critics are high. They panned The Thing.
They were idiots. Yep.
It was the same for Big Trouble in Little China. It came out in 1986.
Yeah.
In my opinion,
America wasn't ready for Big Trouble in Little China.
It wasn't. Should have been the biggest action movie of the year.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. It got panned.
Yeah. Mm. If it was made a decade later,
if it was made in like mid-90s, post-Blade, totally work. Like post-Blade and Charlie Futz come in for replacement killers.
Yeah.
People be like, ooh, put Donnie Yen in that role. Yeah. Totally would work.
So, Kai?
Yeah.
John Carpenter.
The thing with John Carpenter that I realized was that, the first time I was aware I was watching a John Carpenter movie, it was probably around 96, and I'm starting to read more about, 96, yeah, 96, I've been reading more about filmmaking, things like that. I'm 16 years old, so I've been looking at my film history and, hearing about this person, John Carpenter. And it's my first week of A-level college in England. Me and Jordan Sleiman, who's a dude from Vauxhall, who I've known since then, we started hanging out with these two kids. I think they were Mara students, right? And every weekend, we get to go and watch a movie. So they're like, you know, you're trying to get to know each other. So they're like, okay, look, there's this movie out right now. And we've seen the first movie by this guy. It's really good. So this movie should be really good. And we're like, what's it called? Escape from L.A. You know, Escape from New York is so awesome. Escape from L.A. is going to be even better.
Oh, no.
So this is my first, what I thought was my first introduction to John Carpenter. Like, okay, John Carpenter's Escape from L.A. And as I'm watching Jane Fonda surfing with Snake Plissken, I'm like, what the hell am I watching? You know, and the thing is, I thought that was my first time watching John Carpenter, but it wasn't. You know, when you told me you were going to record this, I started looking back at his filmography. The dude is a big part of my childhood. Big Trouble in Little China is one of my favorite films from, like, there's this bunch of films from the 80s that kind of shape you as a growing up. Big Trouble in Little China is definitely in there. You know, because one of the few Hollywood films that had a strong Asian representation.
Strong Asian representation. Yeah. Also shown on local TV.
Yes.
Mm. And that's where I first watched it as well. Yes.
And then he did Starman, which I loved the movie. I loved the TV series. I didn't know that was John Carpenter either. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, wow, this guy's done a bunch of stuff that I didn't even know about. Of course, it's Halloween when I watched it on TV in 4:3 and it wasn't the greatest experience ever. So...
You know, John Carpenter is one of these interesting guys because when it comes to genre filmmaking, from 1974, which was his first film, right? Dark Star, 1974, all the way through to Ghosts of Mars, not his best work, but in 2001, I think, Ghosts of Mars, he never stopped being a genre filmmaker. Well, and there are so few genre filmmakers left.
2010, he had...
The Ward.
The Ward. Mm. Anybody see that?
Yeah.
I haven't seen that. What was that like, Tony?
It was better than Ghost of Mars. But it was, in a way, it was also like the final nail in his coffin as a director. I think he realized that he kind of lost his mojo at that point.
Really?
It wasn't bad, but it was basically... Have you guys seen Identity?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's Identity in an asylum, basically. You know, I think I just spoiled it for you guys. But,
so now we know the twist.
You know the twist. But
he's coming back. It was recently announced that he's doing a follow-up to Halloween.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So it's not going to be like Halloween 2, Season of the Witch?
That was Halloween 3. 3.
Which is great, by the way. Halloween 2. So underrated.
Which one's Halloween 2 where Mike Myers is nowhere in it?
3.
That's 3.
Season 3.
Yeah.
That had nothing to do with him, right?
That had nothing to do with
basically,
it.
Basically, John Carpenter decided that maybe he was done doing Mike Myers stories.
Yeah.
And so what he thought would be a good idea was to create a Halloween movie every year almost. I think that was the plan.
And the theme was Halloween.
Yeah, just to keep telling Halloween stories.
Yeah.
But Mike Myers is the guy. Mike Myers is the franchise.
Yeah.
And, you know, unfortunately, there are like 17 Halloween movies. with varying degrees of success.
H2O ain't bad. H2O ain't bad.
You know, but dude, 1978, when Halloween came out, right, it was made for $300,000 and went on to gross $70 million.
You know,
and
Halloween
launched every single copycat.
You know, Halloween is the reason why Sam Raimi did horror?
Really?
I have a bunch of Sam Raimi biopics. And the thing was, like, they were into comedy. They wanted to make slapstick. They were big, you can see it, Three Stooges fans. Huge Three Stooges fans. They wanted to break into film. And they approached it like businessmen. So they went to the drive-thrus and like, okay, what are the lowest budget films that make the highest profit? Halloween was top of the list. Yeah. So they decided, okay, we'll make a horror film. Because then they had something statistically that they could show to investors. That was the main reason, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's the main reason they were doing Evil Dead.
Yeah.
It's like, no one's going to pay to watch us Three Stooges wannabes, but dead people, yes.
I mean, it's always a great place to start. You know, horror is all, but I think just adding back to the whole Halloween thing, I mean, if you take Jaws, for example, Jaws, you know, launched the modern summer blockbuster, you know, for better or worse, you know, everything started with there. Halloween probably did the same. Not just for horror and slasher films, but later down the line, it had a ripple effect. Mm. Independent films in general.
Yeah.
You know, that was the major turning point right there for indie cinema, and which basically came full circle with Blair Witch Project.
Yeah.
You know, where, you know, it was a film which cost it for like, you know, $20,000.
We were looking at the other day, you know, it was 15 grand.
15 grand, shoot, okay. Even better, you know, and it repeated the same kind of phenomenon where it just grossed... you know, past the 100 million mark, if not more.
And then recently,
and today we're seeing with the Paranormal Activity, with the Purge, movies like that. You know, with Halloween, though, soundtrack is one of the scariest pieces of music ever written.
Yeah, yeah. How...
Dong, oh, those meaty sound effects.
Wow. Oh, yeah. Music, you know, that's another thing that a lot of people don't really give cred to.
Oh, yeah, he writes the scores.
He writes the scores. He's very unique. His style is very unique. And it actually stems from the fact that he wasn't really, but I think by his own admission, he wasn't really a great musician. And I think that's where the minimalism came from, you know. But it became his thing, you know. And it's just, in terms of how you could evoke atmosphere, and suspense, you know, I think he was one of the best in terms of just, you know, just underscoring to maximize effect, you know, as opposed to everything else. It's like,
where the music is used.
Yeah, yeah. It's wall to wall, you know.
Yeah, he never used the music as a kind of emotional punchline.
Are you coming down on the bong?
It's just so oversaturated, no, but
it is. Music should not be used as an emotional manipulator, right? It's at best an enhancement, a punctuator, possibly.
Yes.
Carpenter, what's interesting as well is that, you know, he's got his inspirations.
Yeah.
Howard Hawks being his big hero. Assault on Precinct 13, of course, was loosely based on Rio Bravo.
Yep.
And if you get the DVD for Rio Bravo, John Carpenter does commentary on it.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, I was watching Rio Bravo and John Carpenter does commentary on it.
Yeah.
But he's such a studied filmmaker.
Yeah.
And it shows in his films, the framing of shots.
Yes.
Even just going back to Halloween very quickly before Assault, that opening scene through the POV of Michael Myers, and not even that, through his mask.
Through his mask,
is absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
And it holds up as well.
It implicates you into it. You know, you are stuck there, like you cannot turn away. You can't look at something else because you're stuck in this guy's eyes, just killing this woman. Spoilers, it's his sister.
So talk to me about his, I don't want to use the word lesser works, but I think
we all have them.
We all have
By
them,
lesser
right?
works, you mean like the ones that weren't as famous or the ones that you're like, ooh, that's bad?
Things that are out there and good, but somehow just don't get that kind of recognition. So Christine is one of them. It came after The Thing, which got a lot of panning. And I think the only reason Christine got greenlit was because The Thing got some love in Europe.
Yeah.
But you watch Christine, and it is a remarkable movie. Yeah. It's a horror film, but actually, it's so character-driven.
Yeah.
The horror elements are maybe 15 minutes in the whole film.
You're right, because I saw it again recently. Something, of course, you don't notice the first time around, but it looks, feels, and, you know, as you said, it's character-driven. It's a lot like an indie film from the 90s.
It is.
You know, in terms of how it's just, you know, executed.
I think that's one of the things, though, because, like, Christine is a Stephen King story. And a lot of times, those Stephen King stories, when you think about the actual monster and visualize it, it's kind of weird. You know, Christine's a car. You know, you ever watch The Langoliers?
Yes. Like,
they're ball sacks with teeth, you know? But the fact that he, you know, concentrates on the characters shows that he understands the source material very well.
Yeah.
Because that's the whole point of, like, those Stephen King books. Like, you fall for these characters, and then the weirdest crap happens to them. Yeah. You accept it because you care about them. You know, and I guess the same goes with his movie as well.
I mean, you're right about that because, you know, it just came right after The Thing, and he applied that principle of The Thing, you know, to his characters in Christine.
Well, he said, I remember in an article in Fangoria magazine, he felt like a hoe making Christine because he just wanted... He wanted to do it for money, and he wanted to do something different because he wanted to do something that may not be hated. Yeah, and yet, even by all standards, when he was phoning it in, if you will, it was still one of his better films, mm-hmm. if not acknowledged.
Mm-hmm. I gotta ask though, because I can't remember. Does the credit say John Carpenter's Christine?
I think it does.
It does.
It does. Yeah, okay, yeah. I find that interesting because mm-hmm. last night I was searching on Netflix Malaysia for any John Carpenter movies, and there was one, right? And it's one of the few that doesn't say John Carpenter's, which is Memoirs of an Invisible Man.
Oh, right. Came out in 1992 with Chevy Chase.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Sorry, Chevy Chase. And I was looking it up after that because I was... The story isn't great. It's a very by-the-numbers script, you know? But I was just looking up at the history of it. It's also not a comedy, even though it's Chevy Chase, because Chevy Chase wanted it to get into more serious stuff. But I was looking it up because I really liked the effects, which were done by ILM. Brilliant effects, some very early CG work. And there's a quote from John Carpenter on why he didn't put that, his John Carpenter's Memoirs of an Invisible Man.
Oh, why was that?
Because he's like, this is a Warner Brothers studio film. They're not interested in making a good film. You know, it was something, I'm paraphrasing, but it was something like that. They're just interested in making entertainment. And this isn't my movie. This is Chevy's movie. You know, he's been pushing this for 5 years. So no, it's not a John Carpenter's Memoirs of an Invisible Man. It's Chevy's. Because I had no idea that movie was directed by him.
Yeah.
None whatsoever. The same I didn't know he directed Starman. The same I didn't know he directed...
They Live.
They Live. I didn't know he did They Live. I thought They Live was a straight up B movie. You know, Rowdy Roddy Piper. I'm like, this is some straight to video stuff. This can't be real.
I have come here to chew bubblegum
and kick ass, and I'm all out of bubblegum. You look like your head fell into the cheese dip back in 1957.
What a line. What a line. And, you know, They Live, of course, you know, was 1988, which was, you know, in many ways, the peak of wrestling well. Yeah. So you can understand why he got Rowdy Roddy Piper in it.
And it seemed like a low point for
John Carpenter. And it seems like Carpenter. A Kurt Russell role as well, isn't it?
Probably tailored for him. But at the time, it seemed like a low point for him. But now it's basically a, you know, a real cult classic. No, especially in terms of how prophetic it is. You know, about surveillance, about the 1%, you know, all that, you know. And no, seriously, it has great repeat viewing value. You know,
Actually, all of his movies have great repeat viewing value, except maybe some of his horror stuff that still terrifies me till today.
Yeah.
Prince of Darkness being one of them.
Mighty film.
Have
you ever finished watching Prince of Darkness, guys?
No, I have not. It's really messed up, but the two horror films I've never finished watching. Because it always came on TV when I was younger. Many times, actually, both in England and Malaysia. And both times I'd be like, you know what? I'm done. I'm going to bed before this gets any worse. It's The Fog and Prince of Darkness. Prince of Darkness is creepy as hell.
Here.
You know, it just has this very creepy vibe. And at one point, like, I still don't know what happens in the end. I'm like, I'm done with this green ooze and crap. This is not Ninja Turtles. I'm out. And then The Fog, that fog... What is in the fog? Okay, so can you guys tell me, because I still don't know how it ends. What's in there? Is it that scary that...
Yeah.
Or am I an idiot for not finishing it?
No, it is that scary.
It is that scary.
What's in it?
It's ghosts. It's simple as that, you know? But it's basically a ghost. It's a ghost thing, but it's structured like a zombie film. You know, they shamble around like zombies. But the great thing is... You hardly see them. You only see silhouettes of them for
that's
the most part.
That's what freaks me out so much.
Yeah. Wait. Hold on. So, you know, that's interesting that you mentioned that, right? So with The Fog, Assault on Precinct 13, with Ghosts of Mars, essentially he's making zombie movies, even though none of them actually feature zombies.
If and you he's look never at done it, a zombie movie.
No, he's never done a zombie movie. But when you watch Assault on Precinct 13, the bad guys or the people raiding the police station, they don't talk. They don't have any reactions. They don't say a single word. Even when they get taken out. When their bones get broken or whatever, there's no reaction. They don't scream. They don't scream. And it's this really creepy idea, but there weren't that many zombie films back then. And even though he said he was inspired by them, I feel that Assault on Precinct 13 really set the tone for this kind of locked room zombie attack film, attack from all sides. People who are not usually on the same side teaming up to fight a greater evil. That kind of thing happens because Rio Bravo, it's loosely based on Rio Bravo, but Rio Bravo isn't that. Rio Bravo isn't a sheriff and a bad guy teaming up to fight someone else. It's the sheriff trying to prevent this guy's brother from breaking his brother out of jail, right? But yeah, Assault on Precinct 13 was an incredibly influential movie.
He knows all the songs.
No, you're
just,
right.
Just keep singing those songs, man. Just keep singing those songs.
We need a soundtrack for this show.
Here's a question. Did you guys ever watch Masters of Horror season one?
Yeah, Cigarette Burns, right?
Cigarette Burns.
Yes.
You saw that?
Yes.
I rewatched it recently. I was like, that his episode, because that series, for those that don't know, Masters of Horror was like a 13-episode series where they got horror directors to do one-hour telling movies. So they had him, Wes Craven, John Landis, like so many people. His is one of the standouts. I always thought that his was one of the big standouts because it's just disturbing. Especially Udo Kier at the end, just feeding his guts to a film projector. It's like, oh my God. The one thing that I found odd about that, it's like, you stick him in a 16 by, in, was it? No.
Yeah, it was 16 by 9.
It was 16 by 9.
Yeah, by then it was already 16 by 9, yeah.
Something goes missing. Yeah. So, like, he is an anamorphic dude.
Well, let's talk about that. Like, he shoots in wide.
Yes.
And he composes his films
fills the frame.
He completely fills it,
And that's something incredible because you don't find that a lot these days in cinema. This is a director that is shooting for the big screen. Mm.
One thing you find nowadays, you can see it even on their viewfinders, they're framing, 16 by 9, but they have TV in mind. They have TV in mind.
They have your iPhone in mind.
So you're taking all those factors into account, and that affects the framing. Mm. They even see in TV these days, like even though we all, like 16 by 9 is the norm now, they still frame for 4 by 3. Just there's extra bits on the side. That's it. You know, and I think that's the big thing. Whereas with John Carpenter, you can tell, like, he is framing for the cinema.
So a lot of us grew up watching John Carpenter on VHS. Right.
Yes.
We didn't have many opportunities to watch these movies in Malaysian cinema. No. That being said, we had a completely different experience because rewatching this in the age of Blu-ray, DVD, and Netflix, we see the movies the way they were supposed to on our however big our televisions are. And that opening shot in Halloween through Michael Myers' mask is a completely different experience watching it in wide as opposed to regular old TV squishiness.
Yeah.
Even the still frame when he goes into that town in Illinois and it's just that empty street which is kind of grayish brown and then there are leaves falling. Yeah. It is a creepy looking street.
Yeah.
But when it's squished and the words are in the center, it doesn't have that effect. But when it's wide and it feels so much more spacious, it feels eerie.
Yeah. You know, hence the reason why I appreciate it so much more when revisiting it on, I think the first time I saw it on widescreen was on Laserdisc. Something really. And just a decade earlier, I was like, this isn't scary. You know, and it was a crappy VHS, and
especially when you see Jamie Lee Curtis and then there's that pan and scan. So it has to pan and scan to Mike Myers in the background as opposed to seeing it all still.
Ooh. He really knew how to milk his rule of thirds.
I bet the TV distributors were always annoyed with him.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
You know how much work we have to do? Can't you just frame them in the middle?
We either have to pan and scan or crop.
Yes.
And it's really, really ugly.
I wonder if he cared.
Probably not.
Carpenter? Right?
No, he was a vocal proponent of anamorphic widescreen, and therefore he probably didn't care about video.
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
If you think about it, a lot of his stuff has been remade in the past 10 years.
Okay. Yeah, so Assault on Precinct 13 has been remade. Mm. Well, Halloween, the 9 sequels.
I mean, that's still kind
you
of like...
You can consider them remakes in a sense.
Well, the Rob Zombie versions.
The Rob Zombie versions are reboots.
Yeah. Yes.
Those are definite reboots because he did one of the... He did a bunch of the sequels.
He did.
You know, H2O and a bunch of others. But you have, Assault on Precinct 13 with Ethan Hawke and Lawrence Fishburne. You had The Fog.
Which we don't want to remember.
We don't.
Did you see the bad posters for The Fog in Malaysia where it's just decapitated heads on spikes in the cinema?
Oh, I did not see that.
That was the poster.
What the hell?
I was like, what? They remade The Thing,
like a prequel.
It was a prequel and a reboot. Pretty awful, too, yeah.
It was bad?
I wouldn't say bad, but it was, like, unnecessary.
Okay.
you kind of wish it didn't happen, you know?
They rebooted, I think, those three, and then, of course, Big Trouble in Little China with The Rock.
Rock on the way.
I kind of don't mind that simply because, I mean, a lot of people have been uproar about him doing that and Jumanji, but... The Rock usually has respect for source material. So I'm like, okay, I'll give it benefit of the doubt.
I know, and you know what? He's a charming guy. Yeah, every time I've seen him in a film, I've enjoyed the movie, for better or for worse, right? But for me, what's interesting about Big Trouble in Little China, I mean, it's for me too, it's one of my favorite John Carpenter movies. Mm. And it's right up there, probably because it's one of the first ones I saw. And so that sense of nostalgia is there because in my head, it was the superhero movie. Because I'm watching this movie and then there are these three gods, weather gods.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah. And there's Lopan. Yeah, yeah. And Kurt Russell isn't the hero.
Egg Shen.
That's one of the Egg things Shen. I loved about that movie because especially growing up Asian in white man's land, the lovely land of England, you know, there's not a lot of stuff you can relate to. Like up until that point, the one movie I had where I'm like, ooh, I can kind of relate to this is Temple of Doom because, you know, Short Round is Asian.
Like, Mola Ram.
I could be Indy's sidekick, you know?
All the Indian fellas were bad guy.
I know, right?
Unfortunately. I'm sorry.
Kalima!
But then you watch Big Trouble in Little China and you're like, oh crap, the white guy's the dumb one.
Yeah.
This is awesome! Yeah.
And that's exactly what it was. Yeah. Kurt Russell's role was simply to be there in between and explain Chinese people to the rest of America.
It felt like Snake Plissken was out of his depth.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, he's trying to be a badass, but... Yeah. He doesn't know how to deal with any of this. And with all the other Chinese guys like, oh, it's a Saturday.
Yeah. They've got, you know, they're like even the opening scene for that movie is so great. The first 2 minutes is Egg Chen in this lawyer's office, right? Yes. And he's like, I suppose you believe in Chinese black magic. And he's like, and sorcery and gods. And he goes, of course I do. And he goes, I suppose you expect me to believe that
you really
too.
Believe in magic.
Why would I do that? And he puts his hand up.
In Chinese black magic.
Yes.
Oh, absolutely.
Are you still serious about this? And monsters and ghosts as well, I suppose.
Oh, sure. And sorcery.
And I suppose that you expect me to believe in sorcery as well.
Of course.
Why?
Because it's real.
How can I know that, Mr. Shen?
How?
Yes, how? Help me out here. Please, how?
Great moment, and then you see the truck with John Carpenter's... I'm just going to defer... That's exactly right. I'm just going to defer to Tony every time
Pork
I get a musical,
Express.
Musical interlude, right? Absolutely.
Burton and the Pork Chop Express, and I'm talking to whoever's listening out there.
Like I told my last wife, I says, honey, I never drove.
You see how tightly that story is? Like, you get to that scene, then it goes to the opening credits. Jack Burton with his friend gambling. Then they got to go to the airport, pick up the dude's girlfriend, and from then on, the crap is the fan nonstop.
It doesn't stop,
right?
That street fight scene.
Yeah,
is like,
first, like, some people kidnap him. Then they go into a street, the car chase with a truck. Yeah.
And it's got every single superhero trope. Yeah. He's not wearing a costume, but he has a super serum. Yeah.
Exactly.
Which he drinks.
Yeah. Out of the blue, like, you have, like, this funeral that turns into a gang fight, that turns into supernatural gods coming down.
I know, it's just like one after another. It was like, wait, what's mountains? It's brilliant.
And every single John Carpenter movie, not a single one of them has any exposition whatsoever, which is what makes his movie so gold.
You just go to it.
It alludes to a much bigger world.
Yeah.
And you can sit around pondering what that world is, but he's not going to spell it out for you. And I love that.
I think the best analogy is an onion, you know. You just keep peeling it.
It has layers.
Layers. You just, you know, nothing is revealed from the get-go. It just keeps peeling back until more and more is revealed in that sense. And I think that's brilliant.
His movies are incredibly tight. Big Trouble in Little China, it's like an hour, 39 minutes.
Yeah. And it really holds up well.
You know?
Oh, it's 30th anniversary, by the way, in a month.
In HD as well, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, that's another movie that I saw in 4x3 and watching widescreen like, oh, there's stuff happening at the side. Okay, I gotta watch this.
It was a movie, however, that drove him out of Hollywood. It was a massive flop.
They totally weren't ready for it. You know, they weren't ready for the Asian invasion.
On that note, I mean, not just Big Trouble in Little China in itself, you know, because, you know, we all love that. You know, I think it's one of those films that you grew up with that wasn't just a film that you treasured in your childhood, but it felt like a childhood memory.
Yes.
In itself, you know, it just became a part of you. And looking back at his other films, you know, so I'm thinking, even back then when I started reading in, like, video cassette review books and all that, and seeing, you know, how much dissing John Carpenter was getting, you know, left and right for every one of those films, I was thinking, am I just a dumb kid who doesn't know, who can't tell a good film from a bad film?
And oh, you had taste.
Yes. We were ahead of our time.
I'd like to think so.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it speaks to how John Carpenter has been so influential on Gen X and Gen Y filmmakers since then. Because he didn't appeal to the boomers, I suppose, at the time. Because he kind of like subliminally, subconsciously affected a lot of up-and-coming filmmakers from that point onward. Starting with Tarantino. Even he said that Reservoir Dogs was, a lot of it was mined from The Thing. And Hateful Eight is obviously The Thing as a spaghetti western.
Exactly. You know?
And then...
And he didn't just influence them. I think it wasn't just the filmmakers. Yeah. It was entire genres and tropes that everyone has picked up upon.
Right.
I would say he invented certain storytelling techniques.
Right. Yeah.
The idea of, especially in Escape from New York, the idea of merging apocalyptic visions with science fiction, with mutants, with all of this randomness didn't actually happen in mainstream cinema. I mean, if you can still consider him mainstream cinema, I call him mainstream cinema, even though he's a B-movie director. Yeah.
Well, he's populist.
You know? He's populist, right?
Yeah, right?
And it never really happened, but we saw a lot more of that following Escape from New York.
Right. Yeah. You know, once again, about things coming full circle, it basically started with an article like in 2014 about, I think it was on IndieWire, about how John Carpenter is probably the most influential filmmaker of the decade. And it shows in a lot of indie films of late. For example, It Follows. And then a lot of other filmmakers like Jeremy Saulnier, Green Room. And then Jim Mickle, who did Cold in July. And then Adam Wingard, who did The Guest and You're Next. And it just goes on, you know. And it's like, so all these emerging filmmakers, who even James DeMonaco, who did The Purge films.
That's right.
You know? So...
The first Purge film.
Yeah.
Assault. It's pretty much Assault.
Second one was Escape from New York, basically.
Second one was Escape from New York.
First was the third one Escape from L.A.?
I hope not. But it's got politics involved. So I'm thinking it's probably They Live, in a sense. but yeah, I think, you know, he's finally getting his dues, you know, 30 years later.
He always got his dues in Europe.
Yeah,
and absolutely. I think in Europe, people appreciated John Carpenter for who he was.
One thing, though, in Europe, they always appreciated the American horror directors. You know, he got props. What's his name? Wes Craven got props.
Romero.
Canada's lovely Cronenberg got props. You know, Romero, Whereas in America, they were just kind of considered, you know, fluff, B-movies, drive-thrus. Mm. It takes a while for mainstream media to honor and respect certain people, and I guess this is one of them.
It's not just a question of honor and respect, though. I mean, I was watching these old John Carpenter movies, and I don't know if I have the benefit of hindsight, but I'm watching them and I'm thinking, wait a minute, as a serious movie critic, writing a review even back then, surely you should be able to recognize the mastery of the art form that he's done. Sure, the content may be schlocky. The plot may be somewhat generic from time to time, but the filmmaking techniques were pretty phenomenal.
See, I think the big difference there, when you think about critics, is that, you know, like film critics get into that game based on their, you know, love of movies and understanding how to, you know, discuss movies. So you think about the film critics at that era, the 80s, they would have been fans of movies from the previous generation.
That's right, yeah.
You know? So I think it'd be harder for them to appreciate it than it would for film critics now who grew up on a lot of that material.
He was revolutionary. You're right. So, exactly. And by being revolutionary and somewhat anti-establishment and rebellious, I suppose he was just breaking the format and breaking the tropes.
And I think as well, with a lot of critics back then, it feels like as you look back at a bunch of movies from that era which people dissed, and you're kind of like, it feels like you're not allowed to say it's good. You know, like you can't say this is good cinema.
Exactly.
Because B-movie plots and monsters and aliens. Yeah. But, you know, we have like this new Coppola film coming out. We must talk about that. Let's not talk about Carpenter. Yeah. I mean, like, come on, man.
Yeah. No, you're so right. Because I was always, you know, under the impression that we had to treat him like a guilty pleasure. And therefore, you know, even if, you know, when I eventually went to film school, you know, I hardly mentioned Carpenter. You know, it was like, oh yes, Scorsese. Well, I didn't mention Michael Mann, who nobody knew at that time.
You're hiding your copies of Fat Gloria.
Yeah, exactly.
But you're right. As a film student, that's something. As a critic as well.
Yeah.
It's almost like you're not allowed to like not just horror and schlock, but anything B.
For
anything more than it's supposed to be.
Exactly.
Right, and that's quite sad. Yeah. Right now, you have the same thing with animation as well.
Do you?
In the sense that I think a lot of people will review and treat animation as if they would review and treat a cartoon, something for children.
Yes.
And when I take something like Inside Out, I'm thinking that's far better written than half of the things that got nominated for Oscars last year.
Treat it as a movie.
Treat it as a film, right? Yeah. Because these are genuine filmmakers. Yeah. And John Carpenter is, a real honest-to-God filmmaker.
He was honest to himself. It was honest to his audience. Take it or leave it kind of thing, you know. And unfortunately, a lot of people left it at the time.
Did Siskel and Ebert, give him crap back in the day?
I think it was mixed. I think some movies they enjoyed, some movies they didn't, which is fair enough.
Yeah.
But to be fair, Siskel and Ebert have always been really, really populist about the kind of stuff they've enjoyed. Yeah. And that's what I enjoy most about them. And it's something which I try to emulate as well, which is I go into a movie and review it for what it is. I'm not going to walk into Dark Star or Assault on Precinct 13 with the same either expectations.
It wasn't Dr. Zhivago.
Exactly. And try and put the same lens that I would upon The Revenant, right? And it doesn't mean I'm being harsher on one than the other. Mm-hmm. It just means they appeal to different parts of my brain.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm actually going to try and look it up right now if Pauline Kael ever said anything about...
Pauline Kael's kind of miserable most days.
Yeah, you know, like she just beats on everyone. She reviewed Halloween.
The first one?
Yeah.
What did she say? 1978, folks.
1978.
Dum-dum.
Okay.
All right.
Ooh. John Carpenter, who made the low-budget scare picture Halloween... Come on, that's the first line. The low-budget scare picture.
There you go.
Has a visual sense of menace. He quickly sets up an atmosphere of fear and his blue night tones have a fine, chilling ambience. The style is reminiscent of the Halloween episode in Minnelli's Meet Me in St. Louis. Wow, that's deep cuts.
That's something new.
Okay, here's one of those things. You know when you get like really highbrow reviewers who want to say something good but put it down at the same time?
I think low budget scare picture is a bit of a put down. Yeah,
it was already judgmental.
Maybe when a horror film is stripped off everything but dumb scariness, when it isn't ashamed to revive the stalest device of the genre, it satisfies part of the audience in a more basic, childish way than sophisticated horror pictures do. The New Yorker in 1978.
Oh, there you go.
There you go.
You have to read it in that voice. So, gentlemen, very quickly before I let you go.
Okay.
Favorites. Can you pick a favorite?
Oh, yes, easily. Kai. Big Trouble, Little China.
I'm always into threes. Okay.
Say Starman.
Undisputed Masterpiece, The Thing.
Ooh.
Okay.
I thought Halloween.
Agreed.
Personal favorite, Big Trouble in Little China. And then in the third category, back to back, Starman and Prince of Darkness.
Okay. Oh, Halloween doesn't make the list. Interesting.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, I mean, it's like in the top 10, definitely.
Escape from New York didn't make the list either.
It's in the top 10.
Top 10.
Yeah, but you gotta narrow it down, you know, too.
Top 10 isn't bad, Kai. It's fine. Top 10 isn't bad.
And I've already mentioned four, you know, so that's pushing it.
Yeah, no, for me, Big Trouble in China, personal favorite. Assault on Precinct 13, I think, is for me, undisputed masterpiece, just the way he frames those characters.
Yeah.
But you're right, I have a top 10. I just can't run away from the fact that I have a top 10 John Carpenter list.
Yeah, yeah.
All of his stuff's that good. Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming and taking the time to talk to me. We've been going on for far too long. I am going to try and probably insert the actual music underneath Tony singing.
Woohoo!
And see how close he actually got.
Fair use.
No more than 30 seconds. Yes. Don't worry about that.
You'll be surprised. I even got the tempo.
Right, so what are your favorite John Carpenter movies? Which of his do you prefer, the horror stuff or the sci-fi stuff or the action stuff? Tweet me. I'm on @UmarPagan and on @TheMoviesMY. You've been listening to At The Movies. This is BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Hi, welcome to the Subway ad for $2.99 subs. How would you like it?
I'll take Drill Sergeant, please.
You got it. All right, now listen up. I want each and every one of you to drop and give me a 6-inch meatball marinara, cold-cut combo, veggie delight, or Black Forest ham on your choice of bread with any veggies you want for just $2.99 each.
Sir, yes, sir!
Subway! Make it what you want at participating restaurants. Additional charge for extras plus applicable tax. No additional discounts or coupons may be applied.